Tim Wise is a prominent anti-racist writer and educator in the U.S. Today, I get the esteemed pleasure of talking with Tim about how to be an anti-racist, about how humility is a very big layer in being an anti-racist, and finding that humility within ourselves and holding space while others find it within themselves. Tim is a very passionate human being and has a very deep history with the subject of racism and being an anti-racist. We talk about where he came from and how he came up and how these experiences have led him to follow the path that he's on now. Tim is an amazing human being. He's fighting such a good fight right now and helping educate the world. I'm very excited to talk with him. Hope you get something out of the conversation. We'll see you on the other side. All right, welcome back to our show. Today, I am very honored to talk with this gentleman. Tim Wise is one of the most prominent anti-racist writers and speakers in our area. And I love the content that you're putting out, and I love the stance that you're taking. It's very, very courageous. And I think we need a lot of courage in this time, you know, to face the things that we've either been a part of knowingly or unknowingly been a part of. So along with, you know, the stance that you take, you're an avid writer, has written many books. The most recent book that you've written, I'm just actually making my way through, called The Dispatches from the Race War. And I love the book, love the audiobook because you're narrating it yourself, and I'd love to hear that. But it's just such an eye-opening example of, you know, the layers that this critical race theory and racism in general weave within our own country, you know, and the way that our politics are set up, the way that our communities are set up, the ways that, you know, we've been raised to live life without even understanding it. You know, a little background for me, and I grew up in Houston in the 80s and 90s, and so very racially charged areas, very heavy Klan influence, very heavy gang influence. You know, there was a lot of just different type of opportunities for racial discrepancies to happen. And unfortunately, in that area, I grew up in a culture that was draped in stereotypes and unfortunately fell victim to very many of them until I was able to understand that and look at that. And I think that you know, a lot of us that struggle with accepting and understanding what critical race theory means and being an anti-racist means might get stuck in that kind of pocket of, well, I didn't do anything wrong personally. I haven't personally been a part of any of this stuff. And so, you know, some of the stuff that we'll get to eventually is how do we start to unravel this stuff without playing a victim card, which unfortunately white people are very good at playing the victim card.
Sure.
Yeah. So, but before we even get into any of that, I really love knowing, you know, how people got to where they're at and the stance that you take and the courage that you have. It couldn't have just come up overnight. So do you mind kind of like giving us a quick, rundown of your history and, you know, where you came from and how you got to this point?
Sure. Well, I will do that. And before I do it, I should say that we have an interesting point of overlap that I didn't know until you mentioned that you grew up in Houston. I was in Houston. I lived there for 5 whole months in 1992.
Uh-huh.
So I was living off Beltway 8, off Westheimer, the exit there in Southwest Houston.
Very familiar with that area.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a place that, you know, I came there with the girl I was dating at the time from New Orleans, where I had been doing anti-racism work, and I'll get to that in a second. Came to Houston because she had a job and I was in between jobs. And after about 5 months, we decided that Houston was too hot in the summer and we had to move back to New Orleans, where we had, you know, 2 seasons at least. Houston didn't seem to have 2 seasons, at least not at the time we were there. Summer is just blisteringly hot. And Southwest at that time was just pavement. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, I read somewhere that Houston has more green space than any city other than maybe New York City because of Central Park, but I didn't find a lot of it.
Yeah.
I guess it's in the Museum District or over near Rice. I don't know where it is, but it wasn't near me. So Houston, Harris County was a lot, as I know, I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. But in any event, so that's a little serendipity between us, but I grew up in Nashville and it's where I live now and have been back here from New Orleans and briefly Houston. I've been back here since 1996. So, you know, so 27 years or whatever that is. And all but 10 years of my life here in Nashville. I was born in 1968. I went to school here, graduated from high school in Nashville in 1986. And it was growing up in the 70s and 80s here was important for who I became, because this was right really at the outset of of desegregation and integration of the Nashville schools. My parents had both gone to schools in Nashville. My father graduated from high school, from the same high school I did. My mother also went to that high school for 3 years until her parents took her away to get her away from the man who would become my father. That clearly didn't work, but he would have graduated from that school as well. And they grew up at a time when obviously the schools were still segregated. And that was even though, you know, we're talking about after Brown v. Board. I mean, Brown v. Board is in 54, but as we all know, the schools in the South didn't really move as the court instructed with all deliberate speed to integrate. And so, 11 years later, when my parents graduated from school, their schools weren't integrated and never had been. So when I started first grade in 74, Nashville was finally had begun busing and had begun desegregation efforts. And my mother, wanting to prepare me for a different kind of environment, she was very excited about the prospects of me being in integrated schools. And as a result, she actually sent me to preschool in North Nashville at Tennessee State University, which is a historically Black college. So I was in an early childhood ed program in 1972, 73, in a Black part of the community, in a program where, you know, there were only like three of us who weren't Black in the program. Most of the women that ran the program were Black women. It was in a quote unquote Black part of town on a Black campus. And I think it was really important. My mom made this decision, three reasons. One is it was a great preschool program. Two was she wanted me to get used to being in an environment where I wasn't always the norm, which is something she'd never been able to do. She was always the norm. You know, white folks tended to be always in our own environments. She wanted me to know something different, you know, which I thought was, you know, in retrospect, pretty deep for a 23-year-old, 24, 25-year-old to think about at the time.
Yeah.
And the third reason was to piss off her parents. So it was all three of those things. And I think that was really important because being in an environment where I wasn't able to take my normalcy for granted meant that I had to be aware of some things and I was going to notice some things that maybe other people, you know, like myself, other white people wouldn't have noticed. So when I get into first grade, second grade, third grade, and my Black classmates, some of whom I had gone to Tennessee State with, at least a couple of them, but even the ones who I hadn't known at TSU in the preschool program, they still look like the kids I hung out with. They look like my friends, you know, and I know white folks always say we have Black friends and we're usually lying, but like I had nothing but Black friends for a couple of years in preschool. And so when they're being treated differently, if they're being disciplined more harshly, even though we're all acting fools because we're five or six and seven, and that's what we do, or if they're being put in a remedial level, put in the other side of the room, given different material, all I know is like I'm being separated from my friends for some reason. I don't have the language for it, right? But I'm observant, I'm paying attention, and I'm realizing that my friends are in some way being treated differently and worse. And so that stuck with me, you know, and then I played ball on teams that were mostly Black kids and I saw how other teams responded and reacted to us, often with overt expressions of racism, which let me know that not only were my friends, not just teammates, but friends and comrades in baseball or basketball, not only were they despised because of their race, but I was clearly also transgressing in somebody's mind against what they thought white people were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So I was getting this really interesting set of messages, not only about, you know, what Black people are, but what white people are supposed to be. And it was very confusing and upsetting and also very enlightening. The additional thing about going to Tennessee State for preschool was that by being subordinated to mostly Black women, not exclusively, but mostly Black women in positions of authority, it meant that I was gaining a respect for Black authority that I would argue very few white people in the early 70s or even today have to gain, certainly not at that age. I mean, how often are white children really subordinated to Black authority? Not very often. And so for that to happen in 1972, 73, put me in a position to then 20 some odd years later, when I was doing community organizing in New Orleans, after finishing college, and I'm working in and around public housing communities, and I'm working with the leaders in those community, the community leaders, often Black women, occasionally Black men as well, but I would say disproportionately Black women. And they are describing to me, because part of community organizing is really active listening, they're describing to me, talking to me about what their lives are like and what their experiences are. And because I had been taught to respect Black authority, and particularly Black women, I was able perhaps to hear that in a way that I wouldn't have been. So I think all of that was really important as a cornerstone or foundational element. And then being in New Orleans and seeing the levels of disparity there, you know, was something that because of that background and that foundation, I was able to recognize in a way that maybe other white folks wouldn't have been. So I was just very fortunate in that regard. When I graduated from Tulane in 1990, where I went to college, I was involved in the 1990 and the 1991 campaigns against David Duke, former Klan leader, lifelong white supremacist, Nazi activist, who was running for Senate and governor. And I was involved integrally in those campaigns to defeat him. So that was how I got my start professionally. But really, in a way, you know, I'd gotten my start when I was, you know, 3 or 4 years old, and my parents were raising me a certain way.
Wow. I commend you for being able to be that, you know, aware of what was going on around you at that time, at that young age, you know, growing up in Texas. You know, I didn't really become aware of the separation between races and the, you know, how unfair each race was, or how the fairness between the races or unfairness was treated until I got into my later teens and unfortunately got involved in a lot of drug usage. And, you know, I was entrenched in the, you know, the drug communities in Houston and, you know, multi-races, you know, everybody does drugs, but I would see, you know, Blacks, Asians, and Hispanics being, you know, targeted more than white people, being pulled over in a car with, you know, two Black guys and two white guys, and the white guys get let go, but the Black guys get harassed, you know, when we all had stuff on us, you know, Seeing that at a very young age, you know, it affected me, but I didn't really see it and I didn't really understand it until I kind of peeled myself away, got sober, and then was able to, you know, kind of sit with that and understand the levels of you know,
I'm gonna hold my dog here. Sorry.
Oh, please, man. All animals welcome. But yeah, just, you know, it wasn't until I got a little bit older that I could actually see, you know, the level of racism that was there and the level of, you know, single it out and what to do with that. But unfortunately for me, I fell into more of a depression about it and was like, oh, well, you know, I fucked up and, you know, I played the vulnerability card where, you know, I didn't want to be there. And so it wasn't until recently that I kind of pulled myself out of that vulnerability and was able to look at it and say, okay, so how do I be better? How can I be better? How can I help with this? And that kind of spurred this, you know, string of podcasts that I'm doing with yourself and one that I did a couple weeks ago. But with, you know, with that, but thank you for sharing that. Cause that's, I love understanding where people come from. And I think it plays such a big role. And I think it helps us understand that, you know, we all can make these changes or these choices in our lives. You know, we can open our eyes and see what's going on and we don't have to put our heads in the sand. We can have a voice about this stuff.
Well, and thank you for sharing your story because it's also part of mine. I mean, I did also notice the disparities in the way that those of us who were white were treated for drug use. I mean, I've told the story many times before, but, you know, when I was in college, I was, for a brief time, I'd been a debater in high school. I was a debater briefly in college, and we went to San Antonio for a trip. And, as we were coming back to New Orleans, it was just the two debate teams and our coach was like, we referred to him as the pharmaceutical gumbo of Tulane because he would bring briefcases filled with drugs. I mean, you know, just ridiculous amounts of drugs. And we knew that we could get away with that. He certainly knew that he could get away with that. We're driving back from San Antonio. We're coming through Gonzales, Texas. I'm sure you're probably more familiar with Gonzales than some.
Yes.
I got stopped driving. I was driving about 73 in a 55. Got pulled over and literally in the briefcase of my coach who's sitting in the back seat is probably an ounce and a half of weed, 8 ball of coke, you know, 6 sheets of acid and maybe 12 to 15 tabs of X. And when the cop pulls us over and I'm really nervous because I know what's in the car, I'm really nervous. I can't find my license. I'm fumbling with my wallet. I'm unable to find it. He asked me to come back to the car with him, his car, so I can look for it with the better light on the interior of the cop car. I agreed because I didn't figure I had much choice. I went back there. I finally found it, but not before he visibly saw my fake ID. Because at first he's like, isn't that it? I'm like, no, I don't know what that is. No, that's like an object. And finally I found the real one. Now, you know, we all know, and you certainly do, that if one of the Black folks in the car, because there was one of the guys on the team was Black, if he'd been driving that car and he'd fumbled around with his license, that car is going to get searched. And when that car gets searched, we're all going to go to jail. because of the amount of drugs. Because the amount of drugs that my coach had in the briefcase, nobody's going to believe that's for personal consumption.
Right.
So you and I both have probably got multiple stories like that. And it was really eye-opening to me. And it was eye-opening to me. The best example of that is in 1993, a buddy of mine and I, this is before I was ready to confront white privilege. I was already doing anti-racism work, but I just didn't like that phraseology, right? Mm. Especially when it was applied to nice, progressive white people like me, right? When it was applied to us, I would get like a lot of people like, oh, not us, you know, the problems are the Nazis. And so there was a woman who'd come to New Orleans. She was going to be speaking at Loyola. She and I are now friends, Sharon Martinez from the Bay Area. And she was talking about, her speech was going to be about white supremacy in progressive organizations. And a buddy of mine and I were like, oh, can you believe it? What the hell? Like, come on, this is ridiculous. We don't have time to have this circular firing squad. Why are we doing this? So he and I went up there and we listened respectfully to her talk. And we rolled our eyes at what we thought were the appropriate moments to do so. And then we left all in a huff when it was over. And then my buddy looks at me and he's like, what do you want to do now? I'm like, I don't know. What do you want to do? He's like, I don't know. You want to go over to Audubon Zoo and smoke some weed? I'm like, sure. Why not? So then we go and we sit in his car and we get high as a kite talking about how ridiculous it is to assume that progressive and left-wing white people have privilege, not noticing the fucking irony of what we're doing, right? And it was years later when it struck me, and I've been in this work for a long time, and it's like, oh shit. Like that was that thing that I didn't want to see. You know?
Yeah, man. And it's hard when you start to understand that you're part of that, right? You're part of the system. You're part of the problem, you know?
Right.
I'll share mine. My moment like that was during, well, I shouldn't say during, but when I first realized what Black Lives Matter meant. Because I remember hearing the term Black Lives Matter in like 2013 or something like that. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't get it. I don't understand it. You know, I was all lives, you know, it just didn't really land with me until it did, you know, and luckily, you know, I've got a meditation practice that allows me to think deeply about some things. And that was one of those things that popped up and was like, man, no, you are part of this, right? You're not outside of this. This is something that you've contributed to and that you've been a part of. So like, understand that. And start unraveling it from there and seeing how, like, seeing what kind of verbiage you can use, what kind of vocabulary you can use that can help not only yourself, but the people around you, not like, you know, shine the spotlight and be like, look, you're doing wrong too, but just understand that we're all complicit in this in some way, right? And when we can understand that, I think we can start to unravel that stuff. But it really is, you know, like a lot of the people that I work with, I do energy work outside of podcasting. And, you know, I do work with people that are confronting that complicity also. And that vulnerability that victim card is pretty strong. And don't get me wrong, like we should heal from our wounds, but don't let that take the forefront of just being a better human being.
Right. Right. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
So before we get a little bit deeper, and because I know terms get misconstrued quite a bit, depending on which news agency you watch or what your social media feed looks like. So could you just help us define like what being an anti-racist means?
Yeah, I mean, everybody sort of got their definition of it, and I don't have a formal set one, but for me, you know, being anti-racist is about taking an active stance against the creation and perpetuation of systemic inequality on the basis of race. And so, in order to really be anti-racist, it isn't enough to confront your own internalized prejudices, though I think that's important. It isn't enough to get clear on your own, you know, collaboration with or implication in racial injustice, though I think that's important. It's also important for you to take active stands against policies and practices and procedures, some of them formal and some of them informal, direct and indirect, that have the effect of either creating or perpetuating racialized inequality. And the reason I say that that's my definition is, If we want to understand racism at the level where the rubber really meets the road, we have to think of it systemically and not simply as an interpersonal phenomena. And so therefore, to be anti-racist, you've got to be doing something actively to confront that. That doesn't mean, you know, everybody's going to do it the same way. It doesn't mean you've got to be in the street demonstrating and protesting. Not everybody's ever going to do that. There are people who are just constitutionally not protest people, and that's fine. But you can be doing that within your business. You can be doing that within your kid's school. You can be doing that within your own school if you're a student. You can do it within the PTA. You can do it within your nonprofit, your church, your synagogue, your mosque. There are ways that you can take stands that are policy related, practice related, that will confront those inequalities. And so to me, that's what I think of. I don't think there's one right or wrong way to do it, but I think that to really claim the title of anti-racist, you have to be taking some type of stance that challenges or seeks to diminish or eradicate those systemic inequalities.
Yeah, thank you for that. Now, in the South, you know, in Tennessee and where you were when you were in New Orleans, does it seem like the being an anti-racist stance is a little harder to do in those areas that have a little bit more history with racism, or at least, you know, the openness of racism and oppression, rather than, you know, other places in the world, like maybe like California or Washington, where I'm at?
I think that from a regional perspective, there are things about being in the South that make it a lot easier and things that make it harder. What makes it harder is obvious, right? That the South politically is a more conservative and reactionary place than the West Coast or the East Coast or whatever. And so it's easier to find like-minded people politically who vote a certain way or who have a general sort of more liberal or progressive mindset, right, or perspective. But what makes it easier in the South and harder in those places like California, Washington, Oregon, New York, New Jersey, Illinois, places like Chicago, and, it, you know, Dr. King spoke to it, said that Chicago was one of the hardest, if not the most racist places that he'd ever tried to organize. What makes it easier in the South is that in the South, it is virtually impossible to become an adult without recognizing by the time you get to that age that race is central to everything around you. It is really hard to ignore it. It is the background noise of everything. And if you're Southern, you know that. And one of the reasons you know that is because Northerners won't let you forget it. Right? And God bless them for that. God bless them for that. I'm not even criticizing for that. But what I'm saying is that because non-Southerners won't let Southerners forget our history, even as they often forget their own, we all sort of know what the background noise is. We all sort of understand that race is in the picture. And as a result, when I talk about racism in Alabama or Mississippi or Tennessee, yeah, I'm going to have a harder time. I'm going to have a lot of reactionary people who push back, but I'm also going to have people who at least know the language. They understand the broad brush strokes that this is an issue, even if they disagree with my take on the issue. And the first time I went to, you know, California for a speech in 1995, right around that time, I was meeting with a black guy there who I've since become friends with, who said that California was, with the Bay Area specifically, was the most racist place that he'd ever lived. And he'd lived in Dallas, he'd lived in Birmingham, he'd lived in North Carolina. But now he's in the Bay Area and he's saying it's the most racist place ever. Now, for different reasons, it plays out differently. It looks different. It has a different set of parameters. But in terms of how he experienced it, I have to credit his reality. I can't ignore that or act like that's not real. So and the same is true when I came to Washington. You know, I came to Seattle the first time in 1995 and all I knew about Seattle and all I knew about Portland the first time I went there was, oh, this is like a progressive paradise. Well, yeah, until you talk to people of color who tell you what their experiences are with police or when they tell you what their experiences are in the schools. You know, I had a young man pick me up in Portland who was a student at Lewis and Clark many, many years ago who was driving me from the airport to my hotel, young black guy. He was like a junior, I think, at the time at Lewis and Clark, and he had his car with him for the last 2 years, so sophomore year and junior year. Said he'd been pulled over by cops like 60 times in the course of 18 months. And I asked him how many times he actually got a ticket. And he said, not once, which tells you either that the Portland police are just the most wonderful police ever. They just give warnings. Isn't that great? Or it tells you that he hadn't done anything. And they were just stopping him on the pretense that he might have done something because he was black driving a nice car and they wanted to smell weed or they wanted to see something sitting on the seat, right? So I came to appreciate that this work isn't easy anywhere, But in some ways, it can be easier in the places where everybody knows to look for it, if that makes any sense.
It does. It does, really. Actually, I noticed that, too, when I moved up to Washington. You know, it was definitely on the surface, it seemed a lot less racially involved. You know, there wasn't as much, you know, energy around that as there is in Houston. But to your point, you know, as soon as I got, so I worked in restaurants for a number of years. And when I started working in restaurants, you start to see the stereotypes play out so many times or be embraced by restaurant workers of all colors, really. And it really kind of showed how systemic it was, but just not being talked about as openly as it was in the South, because there wasn't as prominent of, you know, a black culture there or, you know, Hispanic culture where I grew up, you know, compared to where I grew up at. And it was it was kind of off-putting, you know, because, you know, and it seemed like, you know, the people of color that I did start to speak to about this were really timid to talk about it because it didn't seem like they had a platform, because it was all so under the table and just hush-hush and not really talked about. So it was kind of hard to really, you know, get people to talk about, you know, the ways that they really felt about, you know, like people touching a black person's hair, or, you know, like, oh, it just must be so interesting growing up where you grew up, you know, like the phrases that get kind of regurgitated so many times without realizing the racial overtones that they hold.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Those kind of mistakes would not be as common in the South in many ways, or, you know, as they would be elsewhere. Southerners are going to make all kinds of other mistakes and some of them are going to be super overt. But yeah, some of the just the really mind-numbingly naive kind of stuff like that, that can I touch your hair stuff, or, you know, I can't even think of other examples, but I think your listeners will know. Yeah. Those are just less common. And I think part of it is, yeah, if you grow up in the South, I think particularly if you grow up in the part of the South that I come from, where black folk have such a long history and white and black folk have been around each other for a long time, not on a plane of equality, mind you, but have been around each other physically, culturally. I mean, Southern culture is thoroughly black.
Yes.
You cannot disentangle, and you know, the Southwest is a little different. Texas has a somewhat different history and a different dynamic, but the Deep South, you know, sort of the everything certainly from Louisiana up. Florida's weird, as we know, and we're learning just how very different. But the South, the bulk of the Old South, is very, very much infused with blackness, even in the things that white people take for granted, from the art and the music and the food. I mean, all of it. And I think that level of familiarity, although it never led to equality, and that's still the struggle here, it did lead to a kind of recognition. And that recognition is sometimes the first order of progress. And I think when you don't have it, and I used to not realize this, I used to downplay this as an activist and as a radical. My thinking was, oh, you know, that personal connection stuff is just woo-woo, new agey bullshit, and it doesn't really have anything to do with the work. You know, the work is radical politics. And yeah, it is. But if you don't have personal connection to people across lines of identity, and that could be race, religion, culture, nationality, whatever, I think it is really hard to expect you to stay in the struggle for those folks' liberation as real allies over a long period of time, because you'll easily be distracted by the next shiny thing. You know, one of the things Harvey Milk said about the LGBTQ liberation struggle that was so true was that the most important aspect, it wasn't really going to be protest. It wasn't really going to be that as important as that activism was. It was about coming out, right? He was telling particularly young gay men, but he was speaking just to the entire, you know, larger queer community, right? Like, you need to come out. When you come out, it will be harder for people to hate you because they know you. And people are going to realize, oh my God, my cousin, my nephew, my niece, my brother, my neighbor, this friend of mine at work is gay. And I didn't know that. And I loved, and you know, and I used to think, whatever, that's not the work, but it keeps you in the work. And if you're in the work because you read a book or you took a class on critical theory and now you're like, oh, my mind is blown, and now I'm an anti-racist, so you scare the hell out of me because you don't have the personal connection that'll keep you grounded. Now you're just operating on the basis of your politics or your ideology. And what I'm trying to do is I'm operating from that place where, you know, at the age of 11, I'm outside of Nashville, 30 minutes outside of Nashville with my baseball team. And I've got a bunch of white guys who we're supposed to play against, refusing to play us because they don't want to play against black kids. And they're surrounding our car with baseball bats, threatening to beat our asses.
Wow.
And their coaches aren't doing anything about it. And they're calling the black kids the N-word, and they're calling the white kids N-word lovers. Like that, like that's where I'm coming from, right? Like, it wasn't because of a class. It wasn't because of some sociological theory. It wasn't because of a documentary or a book. It was because of what I experienced. And until we are experiencing some of this, I fear, and seeing it and really recognizing it, I fear that we won't stay in the work. That's why I think it's sometimes easier to be from the South and do the work.
Yeah, that's a, I mean, that's an excellent point. And I see that a lot up here in the Northwest, you know, people that just like, well, I've never been racist. I've never, you know, held a sign. I've never gone to a Klan meeting. I've never done this or that, but not realizing that still, you know, there's parts that we all play. And so like, you know, and you talked about the recognition, and I think that's one of the biggest things that we can start to do. Cause you know, our egos are very strong as human beings. And if our ego feels like it's being attacked, then we're going to dig into whatever ignorant statement we made, whether we realize it or not. And so a lot of what I see with, you know, with very, you know, people that have a lot to say about anti-racism in a positive way, like we're anti-racist, we support critical race theory. A lot of times what I see is, you know, they'll, you know, will say something to somebody that has that negative anti-racist stance that is saying something racist and, you know, confronting them about that. But maybe that confrontation is a bit on edge because, you know, sometimes it needs to be, we're flared. But when, so you confront that ignorance, your perceived ignorance with that aggression that you have because you've just been flared, a lot of times that person will just dig into the statement they've made, whether they realize they're saying something negative, racist, or whatever. You know, so in those situations, like, you know, what are some of the stances and approaches that we can have in our tool belt, in our arsenal, to really kind of like encourage the conversation instead of, inciting this kind of, vehemency that comes back?
I think the most important one, and it's hard because, like you said, the ego needs are really strong with human beings generally, but I think especially human beings who happen to live in the wealthiest, most powerful and privileged nation on earth historically, or at least in contemporary history, and that's humility. Hmm. Humility is not something that we nurture in the United States of America. I would say, you know, all humans probably lack enough of it. But Americans really are bad at it because we are not a culture that places a priority on that. In fact, we do the opposite, right? We place a priority on certainty and certitude and, by God, my way or the highway, and the best person wins, and I'm the best because I won, right? The whole notion of rugged individualism, the myth of meritocracy, the idea that, you know, if you made it, it's because you're superior in some way. But humility is really important because if I have a little humility, let's just say as an anti-racist, I just told you at the outset of this program where my conditioning and my insights come from. Now, none of those things, the fact that my mom put me in a black preschool, I played on mostly black ball teams, went to integrated schools, none of those things are things that I somehow earned, right? Like, I didn't do anything at the age of 3 to get those things. I, you know, it's not like I behaved a certain way and therefore I got this reward. Like I just happened to be born to a family where the mother was thinking about this stuff. Well, that was very fortunate, but I can't be haughty about that. I can't have ego about that. I have to be humble about that because if I hadn't had that experience, I could have ended up very, very different. I almost certainly would. When David Duke, who I worked against, as I said, you know, in 90 and 91, lost in those elections. Remember, he got 60% of the white vote in the Senate race. He got 55% in the governor's race, even though everybody knew he was a white supremacist. Everybody knew he was a Nazi and had been a former Klansman, but most white people were apparently cool with that. Now, I could sit in judgment. And trust me, on election night, I did, right? Like on election night, I wasn't in a very ecumenical mood. But shortly thereafter, I had to have a certain degree of humility because I realized the only thing that separated me from those 600 to 700,000 white people, which is what it was, were two things. I mean, number one, I was Jewish, so I know you don't vote for the Nazi. That was sort of drummed into me sort of early. But beyond being Jewish, which was also just, you know, serendipity, it just happens to be that I was raised Jewish. But the other thing that separated me was my life experience. I had a bunch of experiences that led me down one path, right? And these other folks had a set of experiences that led them down another path. And those experiences they had, they are no more to blame for those than I am due credit for mine. And so part of it is being humble enough to recognize that that even when we know some stuff, and even when we are right, I'm not saying there's no right and wrong. Even when we're right and we know we're right, we got to remember how we got right. We got right because somebody either taught us, who we were lucky enough to have as a teacher or a mentor, or because we had a set of experiences that we were lucky enough to have, right? And the thing that we got to remember above all else is it is not helpful when you jump down somebody's throat on Friday about some shit that you only learned on Monday, you know?
Yes.
Theoretically. So if somebody on Friday is saying some really foul stuff and on Monday you learned how horrible it is, you can't jump down their throat 4 days later, metaphorically or literally, and act like you've always known that stuff, because there was a before time, right? There was a time before you knew what you know. And how would you have felt if someone had jumped down your throat, called you a horrible person? You would have gotten defensive as well, for all the reasons that you mentioned. So it's hard to stay humble in that situation, especially when you think righteousness is on your side and when you've got a head full of knowledge. But we have to remember, you know, that people are the products of their environment and their conditioning. And that's true for people in prison. It's true for people who engaged in acts of terrorism. It's true for people who say and do racist, sexist, homophobic, horrible things. That doesn't mean we excuse it, but if we're not prepared to place it in systemic context, and if we're more focused on scoring points against other people and dunking on them as people and showing how superior we are to them as people, we've sort of missed the point of doing this work.
Yeah, you've mentioned the campaigns that you ran that you worked on against David Duke a couple times now, and you know I wanted to bring that up because it seems like you know some politicians are very blatant about their stance. Like you know DeSantis is very blatant about you know doesn't like critical race theory, anti-racism, things like that, doesn't believe in the idea of it. But some politicians are really good about hiding that fact that that's their stance until they get into office and start making some of these policies and some of these changes. So as, you know, just as voters, whether we're aware of what's going on or not, like there's certain things that we can look for to see, like say, okay, so this phrasing that they're using or these companies that they work with, or like, is there something there, is there like a breadcrumb trail that we can look at to say, I like what they're saying, but there is an undertone of something that I'm not understanding until you start to look at it.
Well, the good news and the bad news is that we're living in an era where apparently the gloves are off for a lot of people and the masks are off, right?
Yeah.
The thing about fighting Duke was that Duke was still doing what conservative politicians had been doing for, at that point, probably 20, 25 years, which was dog whistling, you know, certain things. And so for Duke, you know, he did what Reagan had done and what Nixon had done and what a lot of others had done, talking about welfare recipients, talking about affirmative action and reverse discrimination, talking about crime in the cities, and we all knew what he meant. Of course, in his case, it was easy to know what he meant because he had a history as an overt racist, and it wasn't real hard to make the connections, right? Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you know, most politicians, it was harder to make that connection. You could just say, well, they're just against welfare because they believe in small government or lower taxes, or they're just worried about crime because crime is scary and they don't mean black people. But I think what we know from the history of the last 50 years, and, you know, Lee Atwater, who was a famous Republican operative, a conservative campaign consultant, admitted it in 1981 in an interview, which people can Google and they can actually listen to it in his own words. He said, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, but not by much. He said, you know, in 1955, you can say, and he says the N-word over and over and over. I'm not going to say it, but he says it. And then he says, but by 1968, you can't say that word anymore. It gets you in trouble. So you start talking about busing and taxes and crime and all of these things where we all know good and well that at the end of the day, the policies are going to hurt black people more than anyone else. So he sort of admitted what they were doing, and he kept doing it again for another 7 or 10 years until he got cancer and then ultimately died. I think what we're looking for is any kind of rhetoric that plays upon these long-standing racial tropes, because it's possible to oppose social spending on poor people, for instance, for ideological reasons that have nothing to do with race. In theory, it's possible that a person could just take a libertarian stance. They love the free market so much that they actually believe that the government shouldn't intervene in labor markets to prop up low wages, shouldn't intervene in housing markets to subsidize housing, shouldn't intervene in food markets to subsidize nutrition. I get it. I know those arguments. But the problem is that in the last 50 years, those issues have become so racialized, right? As has crime, even though the majority of violent crime is certainly not committed by Black people, about 26% a year. Now, that's disproportionate to the Black population because violent criminal offending is correlated with economic deprivation and all kinds of structural factors. But the point is, if only 26%, 28% in some years of the violent crime is committed by Black folks, according to the victimization surveys that Department of Justice does every year, that means 74%, roughly 3%, 3 out of 4 are not, right?
Right.
And yet if you say, well, what's the image of a criminal? That's what people think of. If there was a survey years ago, there was a study done where they asked white respondents to envision a typical drug user. And like 90% envisioned a Black person, even though Black folks are approximately 14% of the drug users, roughly the same as their percentage of the population. And white folks are about 62-63, non-Hispanic whites, as the census calls us, are 62-63% of the drug users, which is exactly our share of the population. But we've all been conditioned, right? And so I think when you hear a politician using the kind of language, law and order language, it's not inherently racist. You could make those arguments, and I'm sure some would, even if we were a completely monochromatic, monocultural society without any level of racial diversity to speak of. But in this context, to talk about those things is to play fast and loose with race-based stereotypes and scapegoating, as David Duke was doing. And, you know, like I said, the good news is most of the time people are just going ahead and saying it now. They're not even really subtle, which allows us to identify it, but there will still be some who will come along and do that old school dog whistling. And I think if you just look at the history of the last 50 years, it becomes pretty obvious what is being said. When we talk about immigration, we know who's being talked about.
Yes.
Right? So if you're going to be a politician who wants to make those arguments from a non-racist place, you have an obligation to say it. You have an obligation to specify that that's not who you're talking about. Or at least not everybody that you're talking about. And I've yet to hear a politician make that argument. I've yet to hear a politician explain themselves, you know, by saying, hey, you know, it's not just Black folks who I don't want getting public money. It's also elderly white folks. I think we ought to gut Medicare. Like, very few people say that.
Yeah.
Right? There are a few who do. They just want to get rid of everything. But the vast majority are very different about how they feel when white folks are getting government money versus when Black and brown folks are. And that's how you know the difference.
Right on. Yeah. Thank you for that. the layer that I want to explore now is kids, you know, like, so we have, you know, we as adults, you know, we're having these open conversations, you know, we're part of this in some kind of way. But also a lot of the children that are in the lives of us are being affected by this, whether they're being taught one way or the other, you know, and kids are obviously very influential. Right. And so with kids, like, how do we really kind of embrace the child and let them understand, like, what's really going on here? And, you know, in the Northwest, like I said, it's a little bit different because it's not as openly talked about. I guess it is getting a little bit more openly talked about up here. But like, you know, places in Florida where they're banning the idea of critical race theory and they're not teaching, you know, African-American studies in colleges and, you know, all these things that, you know, we learn from the history of where we came from. And if the kids that are coming up aren't given that opportunity, you know, then they're just going to be kind of sheltered until they either find it themselves or they just kind of dig themselves into that stance. So I know that recently you were a part of Critical Race Theory Summer School, which sounds amazing and I think is something that would be beautiful for my children. Is that something that you might see making a little bit more of a taking more of a stance where we have the integration of, like, say your school's burning books and not recognizing critical race theory? Here's an opportunity and avenue that you can explore this on your own.
Well, I would love to see that happen. Now, I should clarify, Critical Race Theory Summer School was not really aimed at or geared toward K-12 students, primary and secondary school students, but there's no reason why it couldn't be, and there's no reason why a version of it could not be developed specifically for that group. I think it's a fabulous idea, and I'll make sure to mention it to Kim Crenshaw and the folks at the African American Policy Forum who put it together. CRT summer school is an amazing thing, and anyone could get. I mean, a lot of it was virtual. Anybody could have logged in. I just think probably not that many high school and middle school students were on the calls, but some were. And I think that's fabulous. But I think the thing that has to happen is that parents who recognize the importance of honest discussion about these critical issues have to be prepared to step up and supplement their children's learning. Look, I went to schools from 1974 to 86, and we didn't talk about this stuff.
Right.
You know, it wasn't talked about. I grew up in Nashville, which is arguably one of the three or four most important cities in the civil rights struggle. But we didn't learn anything about the Nashville movement. Really, whatever I learned about the Nashville movement, I learned from my parents, or I learned from my own research. We didn't take field trips down to the site of where the sit-ins were. We took field trips to Andrew Jackson's house,
right?
You know, which is 17, 18 minutes away. But we didn't take trips to the site of the sit-ins, and you have to ask why. So just because the schools aren't teaching it doesn't mean that we have to despair of the ability of our children to learn it. I think we have the capacity. Look, the far right doesn't wait, right? When they want to teach their kids that humans and dinosaurs lived on the earth at the same time, they have materials for that.
Right.
Right. And they make damn sure their children learn that via their homeschooling efforts and all of that. So it's very dangerous for us to assume that we ought to wait for the schools to do right by our kids on this stuff. If you're waiting for the schools to develop truly fundamentally anti-racist curriculum, good damn luck with that. I doubt that that's likely to happen. I hope they will, and we ought to fight for it. But while we're fighting for it, we ought to be creating those materials, supplementing what's happening in our schools, making sure that all those books that are on the restricted lists or that are being removed from libraries, that we're going to put our money in and we're going to buy those books for students. And we're going to provide them, if not to the library, because they can't have them in there, then we'll have extracurriculars. We'll have banned book clubs at every high school, right? We'll have organizations that will teach this stuff. When the Tucson Unified School District in Arizona had developed an amazing program many years back, developed an amazing program, Chicano Studies program, that was absolutely top-notch, was leading to these amazing outcomes for mostly Chicano students, not entirely. You didn't have to be Latino or Latina to take the classes, but a disproportionate share of the kids were Chicanx kids. And the ones who took part in this La Raza Studies, Chicanx Studies program, were 70% or more of them were going to college. They were on fire for learning because their learning had been done through this pedagogical lens that was of their own experience. The other Chicanx kids who were in the same district, who lived in the same neighborhoods but didn't go through that program, only 17% of them were going to college. So this thing was working, and then the state of Arizona came and shut it down. And so what did parents do? What did students do? They organized. They, all those books that they literally ripped out of the rooms, the superintendent of schools in Arizona had, you know, history books and literature books written from a Chicano perspective, taken, forcibly removed from the schools in front of the children, that just ripped these books out of class. And all of a sudden, though, you had and that should never have happened. And it ultimately went through court, and it was found to be unconstitutional what the state did. But by that time, the program had been wrecked. Luckily, though, there were still parents, and there were nonprofits, and there were churches, and there were activists who were making sure that young people that wanted this material could get access to this material. That's what we have to be doing, even when states and local school boards are trying to dictate what we can and can't talk about with our children.
Wow, that's so beautiful. You know, it's taking it on our own. You know, and I think maybe a lot of us got that taste with COVID, where you know the schooling got put back on the parents to, you know, ensure this and that, and maybe that, you know, can give us that understanding that we can be a part of their schooling and their learning. It's not just a school that's going to teach them the things that they need to know, but the parents, we obviously have a part to play in this as well. And if it's not being taught in schools, how do you step up and fill in those gaps that you need to fill in?
Absolutely.
Well, what what are the arguments or the things that are like very prominent in critical race theory and anti-racism right now that we, the people that support this movement and support this knowledge can look out for and to be a part of, So is there arguments that we're not seeing yet that are starting to surface? Is there different points of views that are coming out that we can start referencing that can really help understand the information that's coming to us and then also help hold space for those kind of like we talked about, the people that the ignorance that we might be receiving. So we're not just, arguing with somebody or, raising our voices. There's actual information that can be shared.
Well, I don't know about that per se, but I do know this. I think that since the uprising of summer 2020, there's been a lot of discussion about what people should do, particularly what white people need to do, and what does it mean to do anti-racist work. And I think, a lot of voices yelling about this, that, and the other, some of them taking, I think, a pretty individualistic approach to things, which is, read this book. Watch this documentary, hear the arguments you need to understand, hear the narratives you need to understand. A lot of other people focused on systemic, which I think is important. But what we need to remember is that we're all just trying to, no one has the answers on this thing completely. I mean, if we did, we would have solved this problem. And so going back to that humility piece, I think, look, familiarize yourself with the core arguments of critical race theory and anti-racist thinking, so many of which have been caricatured and caricatured unfairly. Critical race theory doesn't say any of the things virtually that its critics say that it says. All of these bills that have been passed in two dozen states now that say you can't teach critical race theory, and then they try to define what that is, and they say, anything that makes somebody feel guilt or shame on the basis of their race. There is nothing about critical race theory that is intended or even attempts to try to make white people feel guilty about being white. Critical race theory is a theory about systems. It's not about people at all. It's not a critique of white people. It's not based on individual bias. When people say, well, you're trying to call all white people racist, critical race theory doesn't even say that. Critical race theory is pretty uninterested in white people as individuals. It is deeply interested in how the system of white supremacy has managed to regenerate itself in generation after generation, despite significant reforms in multiple generations. That was the whole point of critical race theory. So, what I would ask people to really contemplate when you get into this discussion is just start with the most basic question: what is a theory, and why did critical race theory emerge in the first place? A theory is simply a way to try to explain phenomena that we observe, right?
Yes.
So if I stand up and I drop a ball from my waist height and it falls to the ground, we have a theory called, the theory of gravity. Law of gravity explains what that is. We now understand that. We get that. There's the theory of evolution. There's theories about everything. And these theories can be observed, they can be demonstrated, they can be proven, but they start out as suppositions about what it is that we're seeing, and then scientists try to refine them and scholars try to refine them. Well, critical race theory developed the same way, right? You had scholars in legal studies in particular who were asking, God, why is it that in spite of the civil rights reforms, which were important and meaningful, that 20 years later we still have all the same disparities in education and housing and employment and poverty and income and all these things? That's a great question to ask. And by the way, everybody was asking it, not just the people called critical race theorists. Liberals were asking it, and conservatives were also asking it. Conservatives asked it and said, well, it's the fault of black people. They make bad decisions. They aren't responsible. They need to stop having babies out of wedlock or whatever the stereotypes are, right? So their theory to explain ongoing inequality was to say it was black people's fault.
Right.
And the liberal argument was, well, the reason we still have disparities, we just haven't quite gotten there yet. We're still working at it. We just need a little more money, a little more time. We're 90% of the way. This was the Barack Obama argument, right? That 90% of the way to liberation, we just got to do the last 10%. I think that's naive, but whatever. That's the liberal argument. The critical race theorists were saying, no, we're not satisfied with either of those things. We're not satisfied with the liberal, just give it more time narrative. And we're not satisfied with the conservative, blame black culture or black genetics narrative. We think it's actually maybe because this thing called racism and white supremacy were more deeply embedded in the culture and the law than even we realized. And as a result, making certain reforms isn't going to be enough. You have to uproot the thinking that's at the core of it. And, you know, MLK said this. I mean, we always quote Dr. King, the most ecumenical things that he ever said. But he also said that America was poisoned, that white people were poisoned to their soul by racism, and that racism was as native to the soil of the United States as pine trees, sagebrush, and buffalo grass.
Wow.
That it was that deeply embedded. So if, and nobody ever quotes that Dr. King, of course.
Right? Yeah.
But the point being, that's what critical race theory is. Now you don't have to agree with that. You can be somebody, either a liberal or a conservative or a moderate, or maybe you could be a Marxist who says, well, but they're all missing the class component of that. Cool. We can have that discussion. We ought to have that discussion because class is absolutely in the mix, as is gender, as are all of these things. But the idea that we ought to be shutting down entire theories, that would be like saying, well, we're going to take an econ class, but we're not going to allow you to study Adam Smith, or we're not going to allow you to study Keynes. You can study supply side theories, but not demand side theories of economic growth and prosperity. Like, it makes no sense. Why would you shut down an entire school of thought? So part of it is just getting clarity on what critical race theory and anti-racist theory really is saying. A lot of the people out there who have said some of the stuff that makes people so upset that, you know, all white people are racist and inherently racist and all that, that's not, the argument that we're trying to make is that we've all been conditioned in a racist society. We've all internalized certain biases. Like, that should be obvious. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be offensive. And it's not just white people that have internalized it, right? The argument is that black and brown folks have also internalized it against themselves and against each other. Right. And so really, to say that you're a racist is sort of like saying you're an air breather. Okay. Like, what next? The question is not that. The question is about the system and the structure. And if we can start with that realization that we have a lot of good people who get caught up in bad systems, then we can avoid all of this hurt feeling stuff. This isn't about blaming and shaming. It's about taking responsibility for the structures of society as we find them. And I think if we can start with that narrative, start with that recognition, start the same way we would with, you know, if you're in therapy, and I am, and thank God I need a lot more of it. But yeah. when you're in therapy, you learn all of the damage that you have internalized. And the whole goal is not to make you feel bad about it, because you're not to blame for what your family put on you. You're not to blame for your traumatic experiences as a child or whatever. But you try to get clarity so you don't keep bringing that stuff out, hurting other people, right? Yeah. You're trying to break a cycle. You're not to blame for the creation of the cycle, but you got to take some responsibility for interrupting it. That shouldn't be difficult for people. That shouldn't be shame-inducing for people. It ought to be liberating to be able to say, you know what, I'm not to blame, but by God, I'm going to try to do something about this because that's the way that I want to be in the world.
Yeah. And that ingrainment that you talked about, I think the first time that I saw that as a conscious person, the contradictory message that I was expecting to hear was from Obama after, I think it was his first presidency election, where he basically, yeah. I mean, paraphrasing, but basically said, okay, black people, you have no excuse. You now have a black president. You know, right. So with that kind of understanding too, and that kind of verbiage that's out there from, you know, prominent black people that are holding political offices or whatever their prominence is, you know, it's like, you don't have an excuse. Look, I made it. Anybody can made it. But that's not also that's completely false, right? Because the people that quote unquote may have made it are participating in the system that's being oppressed, that's helping oppress everybody else, right? And so, you know, with that kind of idea, like, where does the understanding and how do we, you know, really unpack those arguments too?
Well, I think, look, the fact is, if you're raised in the United States, and even if you're not, but if you were raised somewhere else, but you moved here and you've been here for more than a week, you've been taught this about this country, right? That anybody can make it. And then you look for examples to justify that ideology, but it's an ideology. Mm-hmm. And we know it's absurd because, look, how long has America been preaching that? Have we only been preaching that since 1964 when the Civil Rights Act was passed? Or 65 or 68 when the Voting Rights and Fair Housing Act were passed? No, we've been preaching that. We were saying that about America, even during segregation. We were saying that about America before women could vote. We were saying that about America when black folks were getting lynched every week throughout the South and the Midwest and other parts of the country. We were saying that in some form, even during the period of enslavement or shortly thereafter. That mythology is a good 150 years old, at least, if not 250 years old. It may be as old as the colonies even before the country. I haven't really traced it out, but I know it's been around. That notion of rugged individualism and meritocracy for at least a century and a half has been very prominent in our country at a time when it was obviously a lie. So when you can see the history of it and you can see how false it was, you should be questioning it whenever anyone says it. There have always been, James Baldwin said, in the teeth of every regime, those who have managed to succeed in spite of oppression, right? Madam C.J. Walker was the first Black millionaire and I believe also the first woman millionaire in the United States, certainly the first Black woman millionaire. And she became a millionaire making beauty products for Black women that white cosmetic companies didn't see the need to make in the early 1900s. But I should point out, she became a millionaire in 1913, which, in spite of her success, was not a good year to be Black in America, right? It was not. And the fact that she made it, no one in their right mind, I hope, would say, well, Madam C.J. Walker made it. What the hell's wrong with you, Black person in 1913? Come on. It was an apartheid system. We understand what the larger deal was. So we got to be able to hold two thoughts in our mind at once. One is that, yeah, man, human beings are incredible. And sometimes against the greatest of odds, they manage to overcome even the most horrific obstacles. That's a testament to the human spirit. And it's a testament to how special some folks are in the world. They manage to do that stuff. I wish I had that level of perseverance. I wish I had that level of willpower. But that's a freak thing, man. That's not common, right? The reality is that's part of the reality. But the other part of the reality is that we have systems and structures that allow so few of those to happen within certain communities that we can literally name the outliers, right? Mm-hmm. So I can tell you who the first Black millionaire is. Can you tell me who the first white one is? No. You know why? Because there are just too damn many of them. It doesn't even make the history books, yeah. Right? You don't have people walking around going, I was the first white person at this, that, or the other, because the first white person to do whatever it is did that a really long ass time ago. And we still got Black folks that are the first Black person in this place or that place or with this job or that job. That ought to tell you, when you can name the exceptions to the rule on one or two hands, then you know the rule is still operative. And that doesn't take away from the greatness of those that overcome obstacles, but it is to say that we still have an obligation to eradicate the obstacles.
Yeah. The example that just comes to my head as you say that is, I think Serena and Vanessa Williams became the first female Black owners of an NFL team. And so that's right. Still happening. The first Black person to do that, the first Hispanic or Asian person to do this or that, you know, that's right. Yeah, that's such a strong point to make, you know, because the white race is just you're doing that. Right. It's not you're the first white person to do that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Tim, I just am so happy to know that you're out there fighting the good fight for us and sharing that information so that we can be confident in fighting the fight as well. Where is a good place for people to get your content? I know I listen to your stuff on YouTube, your books that you've done, your Instagrams, but is there specific places to go to really, you know, chew down on your content?
Sure. Well, my Instagram is Tim Wise Official, at Tim Wise Official. My Twitter or X, where I still am for some reason hanging out. I don't know. It's just hard. It's like a drug habit. It's very hard to quit, especially when it seems to be the only or one of the biggest games in town.
Yeah.
That's at Tim Jacob Wise. So it's Tim Wise Official on Instagram, at Tim Jacob Wise at Twitter or X. I think it's also at Tim Jacob Wise on Facebook, though I don't post on my page there as often. I am going to be creating an actual formal YouTube page. A lot of my stuff is obviously on YouTube, but I don't have a formal page yet. I will. You can also read my essays at Medium. I can't remember the exact handle there. It's probably Tim J. Wise, but I don't know. People have to look for it, but I'm pretty easy to find over there as well. And of course, you can get the books at Amazon or wherever you get your reading material.
Beautiful. Well, Tim, thank you, man. Thank you so much for doing what you do. I know you're putting your neck out on the line for a lot of this, but you're a very good inspiration for people to follow and to look at and to help find that confidence and courage that we need.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate you, brother. We'll talk soon.
All right, man.
Thank you so much for spending time with Tim and I. Please check out the show notes for ways to get in touch with Tim to see what he's doing and how to support the movements that he is a part of or how to educate yourself. Obeisance and love. We'll see you next time.